Let's play some cards.
From Harrah's St. Louis Casino and Hotel, this is The Final Table, starring professional poker player Dennis Phillips and Paul Harrah's.
Winner, winner, chicken dinner!
Wow, winning.
Now, from the Harrah's St. Louis Poker Room, here are Dennis and Paul on 590 The Fan, KFNS, and KFNS.com.
They started with 6,865 players at the main event of the World Series of Poker, and they are down to their final three with the elimination of Matt Giannetti in fourth place on Sunday. Matt is going to join us in about 15 minutes to talk about that elimination and how he played and his analysis of the three guys who are left, P.S. Hines, Ben Lamb, and Martin Stasko, who will play it out tonight as day 10 begins at 8 o'clock Central Time tonight on ESPN. We've got coverage of it for you here today on the Final Table Poker Radio Show. Hi, I am Paul Harrah, sitting at the feature table of the Harrah's St. Louis Poker Room, while my partner Dennis Phillips is back home in Las Vegas. Hi, Dennis, how are you?
I'm doing well, recuperating quite a bit, and looking forward to today. I'm down at the Rio, going to watch it live up on stage.
Fantastic. Now, you were there on Sunday for several of the hours. Set the scene for us there. I mean, you set the standard for crowds cheering on a poker player in the 2008 main event when myself and a whole bunch of your friends, a couple of hundred of us, went to the Rio dressed in our St. Louis Cardinals hat and our Dennis Phillips shirts, and you had the largest cheering section that year and set the bar pretty high. We packed the place that year, and it's been packed the last two. What was it like this year?
Well, it actually wasn't packed. I was a little surprised. There were some very feverish fans there for several of the different players. A nice group from Ireland that were up there for their man. There was some people from Belize there for their person. There were some smaller groups. Ben Lamb probably had the biggest group there, including one gentleman walking around with nice big pink ears and a little fluffy tail.
Yep.
It was quite interesting to watch him.
Yep.
But to be quite honest, there were a number of empty seats around there. It was not packed. Anybody that wanted to walk in there could get a seat. When we were there, the lineup outside stretched out all the way around the corner of the Penn and Teller Theater and down the hallway for people wanting to get in, and that line stayed there the entire day.
Right.
People hoping to be able to get into it, but never made it into the theater. That was definitely not the case on Sunday. Now, was it because they shifted it from Saturday to Sunday and a late notice, and maybe people weren't able to make changes, or maybe they were watching the football games, or is it possible that with the 15-minute delay on ESPN2, people elected to watch it that way instead? Maybe they could see it a little clearer and easier. I'm not for sure.
I think that is a big factor. I have no idea what the ratings were like for Sunday for ESPN2, particularly up against NFL football, particularly because it took, 10 hours to play this thing out. But, you know, I think that the casual fan, or rather not the casual fan, because they wouldn't have gone or maybe even watched, but the people who were kind of into it and wanted to see it, they didn't have to go to the Rio, as you say. So that would leave the hardcore friends, family, the media, and maybe people who actually were at the Rio that day just because they're into poker and wanted to be a part of the spectacle. But a lot of people, I mean, I didn't go this year. I've been at the main event the last few years, ever since you were there, to watch the November 9. I didn't bother coming out there this year because I knew that it was going to be broadcast nearly live.
And that does make a huge difference. And I will have to tell you, they had two extremely large screens mounted so the audience can see them. And you could follow every action very well. The screen the one on the right had a listing of the nine players. It had a dot that went down the line showing where the action was at. It showed the previous action, what it would take to call, who had the button, who had the big blind, the whole bit right down there. And they were continually, every hand, updating the chip stacks. Somebody was extremely alert and extremely well-versed in this. And he kept it so at the audience, when you're in there, you could follow and knew exactly what was happening at every second. The one thing they didn't have up there, believe it or not, and I don't know if it was an oversight or they just didn't care, there was no time clock. We had no idea when the level was going to end.
Huh.
But with all the other information they had up there, I really didn't care. Very well put together on those two screens, very well organized, and somebody kept it extremely up to date.
So that's if you were sitting in the regular seats at the Penn and Teller
Correct.
Theater. But what if you were up in the kind of Thunderdome seating around them on the actual stage?
Almost the exact opposite. Very difficult to see the table. No update on what the hands were or the chip caps counts or anything like that. You were on your own up there. But each and every player had a handful of people at the rail that they were continually going over to talk to look at their iPads, to get some coaching from. Ben Lamb especially was up and down and up and down and back and talking to them. So I'm quite sure that they had people there that were following it hand for hand, that were relaying the messages back to the players about what had gone on. But actually the best view was from the audience.
Now, when you were out in the audience, not actually on the stage, were people there also in touch with social media? But they didn't really need to be because they were watching it. And if you could, were sitting there and could see it on the screen, you didn't really need to follow somebody's Twitter feed to see what was happening, did you?
You didn't need to follow the Twitter feed or anything like that. But if you followed ESPN2, you could actually see the hands then that may not have been exposed up there.
Ah.
They were showing the hands. There were several crucial hands where somebody would fold to shove on the river, say. And 15 minutes later, you'd see it on ESPN2, and you'd see the hold cards. And it was just awesome.
Now, were there people up there? You mentioned that Ben Lamb was working the crowd, going over and finding out information. Were there people there who had an iPad who could perhaps watch some of the ESPN2 coverage so he could come over and, you know, I heard that Sean Deeb was part of Ben's team. Like, Sean could motion Ben over to the side and say, look, here's what Pius Hines had in that hand, or here's what Matt Giannetti had in that hand. Were they doing that?
Yes, they absolutely were. There was talk about blanketing it out for the theater, or blanketing it out maybe for Vegas, and none of that happened. There were people up there on the stage with iPads open that were following it and relaying it as quick as they could. The interesting thing, some of the hands took so long to play out that they actually had to delay showing them on ESPN2 because they were sooner than the 15 minutes. A hand would barely finish up there when it would be ready to start on ESPN2, and they couldn't show the hold cards then.
Well, the thing about ESPN2 was they weren't showing hold cards until the end of the hand anyway. So even if you had a situation where somebody tanked for 15 minutes, the information wasn't going to be available to them while the hand was still going to be in progress. But you and I talked several times this year after the streaming of PokerStars did it at the PCA, and then the WPT is doing it with their final tables, and the World Series Circuit event is doing it there as well. They're streaming all nearly live, and you were a little bit. I guess you weren't a big fan of the idea. Now that this has happened at the main event, where it's not just streaming, but actually being broadcast on ESPN2, where so many more people can watch it, and the delay is only 15 minutes, what are your thoughts on the impact of that on the game, and do you still not like it?
Well, whether you're a fan or not, I don't think it makes any difference. It's here to stay. It's been accepted, I think, because it does add a new element to the game. And you're just going to have to adapt to it. This game is an evolving game. This is another level of strategy, another level of information, another level that the smart, savvy player can take advantage of. Stop and think for a second. On Sunday, they played for 10 hours, these three guys against everybody else. All of that was recorded. All the hands were shown. You had all day yesterday to go back. And if you're a Ben Lamb, you can look at Martin and at Hines, every hand they played, and how they played it, and what their betting patterns were, and any kind of a tell, you've got them on the screen right in front of you. If these guys did their homework yesterday, this could be, I'm waiting for the interviews afterwards to see who found out what, and who had a tell, and who changes their game today versus what they did on Sunday because of the action they saw on the TV.
Well, I wonder
if any of that's going to happen.
Well, of the three, I think Lamb is the most likely to have done that, because he lives in Vegas, he has a lot of poker playing friends, a lot of pros who could certainly come over and watch that with him and say, did you see this? Did you see that? Or, you know, here's a situation where you three bet or somebody else three bet, you know, all of those situations. I think Lamb is probably poised to get the most out of that. Of the three, I think Stashko is probably the least likely to use that information. Was he using it on Sunday? Was he going to the rail and talking to people to find out what had happened?
he was going to the rail, but I honestly don't know if he was, had anybody following it. I honestly don't know if he was using that information. He had a few people that he would go over there and talk to. Now, remember, he's a chess player and more of a deliberate player. So I'm going to say two things about him. First of all, I don't think he has as many levels to his game as definitely as Ben Lamb does, and probably not as many as Hines does. So I don't think he can adapt and adjust as much as they could if he sees something. But I don't want to discredit this guy. I heard people in the audience talking about how tight he was playing and hands he was folding and this and that. Give me a break. The guy is one of the final three at this. He's now made a minimum of, what, $4 million?
Yep.
Yeah, I don't think you should be slamming him too much, guys. He's up there and you're not. But whether you agree with his play or not, it worked. We even said last week that we thought that was the way he was going to play, that he was not going to get involved in big hands, that he was going to play it rather conservative and safe until he got down to, you know, four, five, six people. He blinded all of you down to $22 million. He got in a race, won the race, shot back up over 40. He's one of the final three. He's dangerous. Nobody believes that he's going to do any bluffing, and he did bluff after in one of the last few hours there a couple of times and got away with it.
Yep.
So he can change his game just a little bit now, not a lot, just a little bit, and get a little more active. And I'm telling you, he could still be a player in this. He's one of the final three. How he got there, you know, wasn't by sucking out, wasn't by passing magic cards. He got there by playing solid, conservative poker, and it worked for him. So, you know, everybody that's trying to downgrade his play, he's up there. You're not.
One thing about Stashko, well, a couple of things about Stashko I wanted to say. One of those times when he loosened up quite a bit was a situation where I think it had been, I think maybe they were down to four or five players, and it had been folded around to Ben Lamb, who's on Stashko's right, and Lamb was either the button or the small blind, and raised it to whatever was the standard amount, and Stashko immediately reached forward and pushed his entire chip stack in there. When he did that, sitting at home, I thought to myself, he does not have a big hand. I mean, this is a classic thing you see, particularly in tournaments, from people who are trying to make a move, or he's realizing that Lamb is going to be very active in that situation and he's going to be raising light, and here's an opportunity to pick up those chips. But he didn't think for 10 seconds or 30 seconds or 50 seconds. He immediately reached for his entire chip stack and pushed it forward. That was the hand where he had done it with 8-7 offsuit, and I thought, okay, this guy is going to be a player, but he does need to slow down there a little bit, because now Lamb will look for that next time. If Stashko does that tonight, Lamb's going to be looking for it. Now, is Stashko, who is a chess genius, clever enough to think that many moves ahead that he thought, if I do this now and I get to the final three, I can do it again to Lamb, moving exactly the same way, and he'll think I'm weak, and I'll have a monster next time. That's what will be interesting to see tonight.
Well, I saw the same thing, but I misread it a little bit. I thought he had a weak hand, but a hand he felt he had to raise with, and therefore he didn't want the call. He had the pocket fours, the pocket fives, something there where, you know, he couldn't lay it down. He didn't want to just smooth call, so he pushes the chips in. And as you said, he did not want to be called. It was obvious how quickly he did it and everything like that. When he turned over, when I saw that it was 7-8, I was surprised, and I have to pat him on the back, let me tell you. Pushing in right there with a 7-8 was a gutsy move, but he had such a table image, he could get away with that one time. As you said, these are savvy players, Ben Lamb especially. He's going to pick up on things like that. If Stashko would do the very same thing the next time with pocket aces, he's probably going to get called.
Yeah. But he has to do it exactly the same way. He's got to make that quick shove. And we have lots of hand analysis to go through here. But for those of you who did not watch on Sunday and don't even know how we got to where we are, as you know, they played the third largest field ever in July, 6,865 players. They whittled it down to the November 9, and then they took the four-month break. Sunday, they regrouped at the Rio with that final nine, and Sam Holden, who was the short stack, the Brit, went out first, which means he didn't make any more money over the course of those 4 months. Yeah. They were all paid ninth place money in July of $782,000 and change, and if you go out ninth, that's your paycheck. You don't get any more. So Sam had to go all the way back to Britain, bring all of his friends over here, probably pay for them, get the hotel, the flight, the whole thing. Lost money on the four-month wait, but I'm sure he's happy with $750,000. Then eighth place went to Anton Makievsky, the Ukrainian, who you and I predicted would go out early because of his style. He had kind of a medium-sized stack or shorter stack going in. We both thought he would be a little bit too aggressive. He finished up in eighth place, made $1 million. In seventh place was the only amateur at the table, Bob Bunara, the guy from Belize, who ended up with a paycheck of $1.3 million. In sixth place was the legacy kid, Owen O'D, from Ireland, whose father was in the final table of the main event twice. Owen made $1.7 million for sixth place. And then in fifth place was Phil Collins from Las Vegas, Nevada, the other American, who we thought was pretty good. Then the guy who went out in fourth place is our guest today, and I'll let you introduce him, Dennis.
Well, we're lucky to be joined today by Matt Giannetti, who did finish fourth, who, in my opinion, played some of the best poker of the nine up there and deserves to be one of the final three. However, poker is not always fair, and a couple of hands spelled his doom and made him short stack, and there's not much you can do about it. But I'm telling you what, Matt gained the respect of his peers through his play, and he will be around, and he will be a force in poker. So welcome to the final table, Matt.
Thanks for having me.
Yeah, no problem. I just, again, want to compliment you on your play. I thought you made some great plays in there, and I loved your style. Can you maybe give us a little bit of a lowdown of what you went in trying to do at this table and how you, what your strategy was to start out with?
I wanted to feel out the table. I didn't know how, players may have changed their approach to the game over the last few months. So the first, hour and a half to 2 hours, I kind of anticipated just sitting back and seeing what was going on. I did have some like predetermined, not so much predetermined, but a pretty good idea of what I thought was going to play out, and a lot of the things I thought were going to happen ended up happening. And just having that confidence that I kind of it helped me trust my reads better, because I kind of I'd put a lot of effort into preparing for the final table, and to see everything that or a lot of what I thought was going to happen, it just made me that much more confident.
Matt, in your bust out interview with Kara Scott on ESPN2, you were obviously devastated and didn't really want to have much to say. I'm curious now that it's a day and a half later, what you think of your own play, and did you get any sleep on Sunday night, or were you playing hands over and over again in your head?
I mean, it was, it's pretty brutal, because I'm very, very happy with my play, my decisions. Only two decisions I kind of, when I had the king queen, I flatted it out of position. I wish I went all in there. I really felt like I, my gut was saying go all in, but then, I was just like, why don't I play a flop and let him, possibly hang himself on some boards. But, and then the 9-10 in the small blind when I was super short stack, I should have just shipped that all in. But besides that, I really like all my decisions. I felt like I was able to outplay a lot of people in certain situations. And, looking back, it was just, I felt like I just got unlucky. I mean, it sucks, because, it's just, that's the biggest stage in poker, and to get unlucky there is. It hurts, but it is what it is, and I just gotta be thankful for having the deep run I did.
To give a little background, Matt came in with a little over $24 million in good solid position there. He chipped all the way up to about $60 million. If my figures are right, and I might be a little off on this, I think five of the first six hands you got involved with, you won, and 10 of the first 12 you got involved with, you won. You just continually, you had to have the total respect of the table. They had to be afraid to play against you, because every hand you got involved with, it seemed like you raked chips. Were you able to use that image then at the table?
Yeah, I mean, I didn't fully exploit it. I was playing more conservatively, which, you know, it allows you to take down pots that, you know, I know there was one hand where Ben had king 10 and I had queen 9 and I just airball bluffed the turn after he checked the flop. But, you know, like for instance, a hand like that against, you know, most tournament players, I think Ben calls there. But because of my very conservative image, you know, for him to call there and possibly have to call, you know, who knows, like 9 million on the river, you know, you get away with stuff like that. So, I mean, there's certain things to be said about, you know, playing a more conservative strategy, which is usually not the typical tournament strategy. It's more, you know, raise the, you know, 2.1 times the big blind and try to take down blinds and innings as frequently as possible. But I felt with the table the way it was, especially when it became four-handed, you know, or the way the table was in general, that I felt like I was comfortable playing flops and stuff. So if I waited to have good hands, I possibly could, you know, take them, you know, I could value bet them to death, or I could, you know, play off my conservative image and take down pots that, you know, I didn't have the best hand in.
This is the Final Table Poker Radio Show with Dennis Phillips in Las Vegas. I'm Paul Harris at Harris St. Louis, talking with our guest Matt Giannetti, who was the last guy eliminated before they got to the final three. He finished in fourth at the World Series of Poker main event. He's one of this year's November 9. We both think you played great. You talked about getting unlucky. Of course, anybody who's played any tournament poker knows along the way you need to get lucky and avoid being unlucky. And you had a couple of hands where the cards just caught you. And I wonder if you'd mind if we analyzed a couple of them, one in particular, was a hand that you played against the guy who's now the chip leader with half the chips, P.S. Hines. You raised the button with 2.6 million. You had pocket eights. Hines three bet to 7.1 million. You smooth called. The flop came king, king, seven, rainbow. He bet 6.9 million, which was about 35-40% of the pot, and you just called. The turn was a queen. It went check, check. The river was a nine. It went check, check. You had pocket eights. He had queen eight. The hand we in St. Louis know is the buffalo. And he had caught that queen on the turn to beat you in that hand. It took a lot of your chips, something along the lines of 10 million of your chips in that hand. Now that I've laid the whole thing out, can you walk us back through what was going through your mind there when he three bets you pre and you just flat, and then you call him on that flop of king, king, seven?
I mean, if you had noticed, I folded the button quite frequently because I wanted to wait for a situation where I felt like I had the best hand. And if you're going to play a more conservative strategy like I did, you can't just get all, you know, in all-in mode when you get three bet there. Like you need to let them hang themselves. And I know eights are not the strongest hand in the world, but I think my post-flop play is right up there. You know, like, you know, I think my post-flop play is my biggest advantage. So I'm never afraid to take a flop and make a read there, especially in position. It makes it that much easier. So I flat pre, flop king, king, seven, rainbow. He bets out the flop. I'm pretty confident I have the best hand. I call, so at that point the pot is 30 million going into the turn. I believe I had about 42 behind going into the turn. The turn's a queen, and what I was anticipating, depending on how much you bet, if you bet something semi-significant, like 12 million, 14 million on the turn, at that point, I was going to probably go all in and protect the pot at that point, which would have been, you know, right around 55, 60 million. But once he checks, I think, you know, my read was that he must have hit the queen, because he's not one to really want to give up on a pot. And so I figured he must have gotten there. So I check, then the river goes check, check, and it was extra sick to see that the other card in his hand was an eight, and knowing that he hit a three-outer on me.
Yeah.
But I mean, you know, I'm never really one to like just want to put all my chips in the middle. Like I'm more want them to like hang themselves and like allow myself to make as many reads as possible because, you know, I think that's my biggest advantage.
All right, I know Dennis probably wants to comment on this as well, but I just want to go to one point there. You thought he hit the queen because he checked. You thought he was more likely to continue on the turn if he had air and to check it when he hit his card. That's a lot of poker players don't think that way. What made you think that about Hines? Had you seen him do that so many times that this was your read on how he played?
I mean, watching all the coverage, you're not going to see too much post-slot play. But based on his style and his like self-proclaimed, you know, I think he, you know, in quite a few interviews, he said that he considers himself a very, very aggressive player. For him to give up there on the turn, and kind of like the speed at which he gave up, you know, the speed at which he checked and stuff, it just, you know, in my live experience, I really felt like he hit the queen. And you know, I have, you know, it sounds, you know, you don't. You may or may not believe me, but I mean, I was fairly confident that he must have hit the queen when he checked to me.
I believe you.
No, I absolutely do, and I'm quite impressed, to be honest about it. You sat there, you played the hand, you were waiting to get in because you knew either, and I'll put Ben Lamb in this, either one of those two with the aggressive style he had would be likely to put a lot of chips in there on a bluff. If he hadn't hit the queen, if a jack had come and he bets out about $12 million. Suddenly, you're the chip leader. That one card may have changed the entire course of this whole tournament when that queen pops up there. That's just sick. You had him play perfect.
I'm very aware.
Yeah.
I'm sorry. I don't mean to rub it in. I apologize. That's not what I meant. But it's just like, wow. How can a queen show up there, a 3-out or a 6%er?
Yeah.
Wow.
The other hand, Matt, that I wanted to ask you about was the one against Ben where you raised the button again to $2.6 million with Jax, and he shoved nearly $27 million. You snap-called, essentially, with your Jax, and he turned over ace-seven of hearts, and then he catches three hearts, two hearts on the flop and the four hearts on the turn, and doubles up to $55 million, and you're crippled to $7 million. My question for you is, are you surprised to see him reshove with ace-seven there?
I am. Against a player like me, I don't know, I could be wrong, but I think if he had to do it over, I think he would have just 3-bet me. But, you know, if he makes it like 6.3 or 6.4, I think he can find out a little bit. And I understand he's only going to have $20 million behind at that point, but if I ship all in, and I don't think there's many hands that I'm not calling his all in with that I don't 4-bet all in, and they all have him dominated. But you know, if he thought that was the best way to play, you know, I'm not gonna. You know, he's a good player, so I mean,
yeah.
But I personally think he if he had to do it over, he probably would have 3-bet.
Dennis,
but,
were you surprised by that? I mean, if this had been P.S. Hines who had raised on the button and Ben does that, it makes more sense than against Matt, who had a conservative image.
Oh, absolutely. I was totally shocked when he turned over an 8-7. And very surprised, because you said maybe he considered himself short stack with 20-plus million. I don't. He had enough big blinds. He had plenty of things. And Matt's insta-call was a no-brainer. You're four-handed. You got pocket jack. How often are you going to lay that down? I mean, maybe if Ben 3-bets and Martin shoves all in, you're going to at least think about it. But it's four-handed. It's very difficult to lay down a hand like jack. So the insta-call was no problem. Everybody's going to call there. But shoving with an 8-7 against a gentleman who has the best image at the table at the present time for playing quality hands and playing well, I was very surprised that he shoved there.
Yeah, me too. Matt, we were talking before you joined us today about the social media aspect of this and ESPN broadcasting it nearly live on the 15-minute delay. We know that Ben was very, very active in going to the rail and talking to some of his supporters and getting information about previous hands. Were you doing the same?
I was. I had a few friends in the crowd. I would just kind of you know, let them know which hands I really wanted to know about, and I'd also tell them, you know, any hands that you think I should know about, let me know. You know, like if you see something surprising that, you know, there's certain hands that, you know, for sure you want the information on, and other hands that you might not realize that something kind of weird went on. And they were keeping me posted, but at the same time, I went back and forth, you know, a decent amount of times, but maybe not as much as the other players because I really like everything.
Because when you're up and you're walking around, you can't be watching the play and how people are reacting and pick up tells and that sort of thing. But were you able to use any of that rail information?
Oh, yeah. I mean, of course. I mean, when you see the frequency, one thing that was kind of interesting is when Ben Lamb, I believe he 3-bet twice in a row with like 9-5 suited and like, you know, it was two very, bad, you know, it was pretty much air balls, you know,
yep,
that he was 3-betting with, and he did it in back-to-back hands. And, you know, that could be kind of, you know, just because he saw a spot and he did it that way. But I think, I mean, this is a guess, but this is like what I'm based, you know, what I think is because of the 15-minute delay, I think Ben probably chose to do both those hands very close to one another, you know, back-to-back, because when he finds out about one, he finds out about both of them. He knew that, you know, the second one would be harder to get away with if he put it, you know, 16 minutes later when he knew that he got 3-bet light. So if you put them closer together, then you're more likely to get away with them because they don't know that you bluffed them the first time.
This is getting into so many levels. It's amazing. You have three players left. You now have the luxury of watching 10 hours of play on Sunday and seeing how each of the other two played in a number of hands. Of the three of them, who do you think is going to take advantage of that, being able to see how they played on Sunday? And who do you think can adjust their game maybe to better play against the two?
I mean, I think Ben's going to win. It's, you know, Puig does have the chips right now, but, I mean, Ben has very good feel, you know, for the most part. I think he probably made a couple decisions he would regret on Sunday, but, I mean, that's not the norm for him. He normally plays very, you know, very, very good poker. You know, I don't know the extent of Stasko's shorthanded experience. I don't know. I definitely think Ben's going to have the upper hand today.
Well, he's going to have to double a couple of times through Hines to get there. And by the way, the odds at this point are that P.S. Hines is just under 2-1, Ben Lamb 3.3-1, and Martin Stasko 4.8-1. At least that's what the bookmakers are making it this afternoon, just hours before the final three play it out. One other American was in this. That's Phil Collins, and he played what I thought was a very unorthodox style, in that he was limping pre-flop a lot. When the blinds were 500,000 and a million, he was quite often just putting in the extra half a million or limping his way into a lot of these pots for a million. Were you surprised that that was his style?
Shocked. I didn't understand what he was doing. Maybe, you know, I don't know. I was very surprised. I mean, maybe he has reasoning behind it that I'm not, you know, I can't really see. But I was very shocked how he played. I didn't really understand how he thought that, you know, would be the, like, optimal way to play.
I was very shocked, too. And he dribbled down in chips, and then he doubled up against Ben. And I thought, well, now he's going to change his play. And he went back to just more of the same. I can't explain that one either.
Right.
So he was basically a non-factor up there.
So Matt, will you be going to the Rio tonight to watch these three guys battle it out, or are you done and on vacation?
I think that'd be a little too painful for me.
Yeah.
I mean, I'm sure I'll watch it. It's, you know, if I don't watch it tonight, I'll DVR it and watch it. But yeah, it's still pretty painful for me. So I think I might have to stay away from it for a little while.
Are you going on vacation anywhere, taking some time off?
I'm actually headed to London on Friday for, like, Poker Premier League or something. I'm not exactly sure the title of it. It's like a 12-player like tournament point system TV show. I'm not exactly sure.
So you're exactly not going on vacation at all. You're going on a trip, but it's not vacation.
It's another poker trip. Yeah, no.
Prior to this, during the hiatus there, did you get any information from anybody? Did you sign up any particular coaches or friends to circle around with you?
I really didn't strategize at all with anyone for the whole thing. And then on Thursday before, a few days ago, I guess it was, my buddy Noah flew in, and I basically, Noah Schwartz, and I basically went through the film with him, and it was more me speaking to him. I mean, throughout the main event, leading up to the final table, me and him were back and forth, you know, playing with different, you know, strategies for the table. But then going into the final table, I did all my, you know, own research for the most part. And then Noah came over and I kind of showed him, hey, this is why I think this, and this is why I think this is going to happen, and so forth. And he was very, having him there saying, oh, yeah, I see that too, and I agree with you. Yes, I do think this player will be likely to do this, and, you know, I think this play will be, you know, good too. You know, having him agree with all the stuff I'd come up with, you know, made me that much more confident in you know, how I wanted to approach the final table.
Well, that confidence really paid off, and both Dennis and I really admired the way you played this. You know, as Dennis mentioned in the introduction, poker is a game where the cards can catch up with you no matter how skilled you are, and that's exactly what happened to you. But we really appreciate you taking the time to talk with us here on the show today, and I hope you have a great trip to London, and we hope to have you back on the show sometime in the future when you make another big final table.
All right, thank you for having me.
Matt Gianetti, the guy who finished in fourth place this year, earning $3,012,700 pre-tax for playing a terrific World Series of Poker main event this year. We have to take a break. When we come back, we'll fill you in on what's going on here at Harrah's St. Louis, and we have more analysis of what went on, including our thoughts on ESPN's nearly live coverage of that main event. As we continue with the final table, Dennis is in Las Vegas. I'm here at Harrah's St. Louis. This is the Final Table Poker Radio Show on 590 The Fan, KFNS, and KFNS.com. And don't forget to download our podcast via iTunes or on thechipleader.com.
Kids, are you caught up in that old game of shuffling your debt around and hoping you'll get lucky and win the jackpot? Well, it's time to deal. Mortgage rates are low and savings are high. So stop bluffing and call 800-GRANNY-8 or go to granny8.com. You bet our friendly loan officers make it easy, and we don't have an application fee. So call 800-GRANNY-8 and you'll be holding all the aces.
Great mortgage rates, call 800-GRANNY-8.
Granny8.com.
This is the Final Table Poker Radio Show. Show number 146. If you have missed the previous 145, you can get the archives from Dennis's website, thechipleader.com. Look on the right side of the page. There's a list of every guest we've ever had, and you can go directly to those shows there or listen via iTunes, subscribe to the podcast that way. We do the show thanks to our friends at Harrah's St. Louis, who have a big promotion coming up this Friday, which will be 11-11-11, and they're going to give away jackpots of $1,111, and one winner is going to get $11,111. When they do that drawing at 11:11 p.m. You just come in between 11:11 a.m. and 11:11 p.m. and you swipe your card and you're in there, and for every 100 base credits you'll get an extra entry. We're giving away lots of cash here this Friday, 11:11:11 from Harrah's St. Louis. And we're also 3 weeks away from the Gateway Poker Classic, which will be another big event here to kind of be a partner event for the circuit event that goes on here in April. This is going to be the first time ever for the Gateway Poker Classic, starting December 1st with a Jack and Jill event, and then continuing from the 2nd through the 11th with three events every day, buy-ins of $250 to $350 to $550 to the main event of $1,100. Satellites will happen on the last weekend of this month. $125 buy-in for the satellites, and I think for every 9 or 10 players who enter this thing, there will be a seat in the prize pool for that main event. I think we'll probably fill up quite a few seats for that as well. There will be No Limit Hold'em. There will be Limit Hold'em. There will be Horse. There will be Omaha. There will be Pot Limit Omaha. There's a seniors event, a ladies event. For information, go to Facebook for the Facebook page of Harrah's St. Louis Poker Room. If you like it, you can get the whole schedule there and details as well on the whole tournament schedule here. And one other quick note, Dennis, you don't even know about this, but we've moved the 5-10 game in St. Louis to here on Tuesdays. Because we feel, you know, we don't have enough games in the room between the tournaments and the 1-2 games and the 3-6 games and the 20-40 games and the 2-5 PLO games that are going on here. Now the 5-10 No Limit game has moved here. We started it this afternoon at 1 o'clock. I was playing in it, and I'll go back to it as soon as the show is over here today. So lots of action. This is really the place to come and play in St. Louis. It's Harrah's St. Louis. Now, let's talk a little bit more about the main event. I know you said that you were at the Rio for many of the hours on Sunday for the beginning of the November 9, playing it down to the final three. Did you get to see any of the ESPN2 coverage, and if so, what did you think?
I did see quite a bit of it, and I thought they did a very good job. Again, and Antonio does an excellent job there. Tuchman is a very good announcer, and supplementing with Lon and the other guys there. I thought they covered it very, very well. Phil Hellmuth was there. I didn't agree with all of Phil's analysis of it, to be quite honest, but that's poker. We have different ways of playing, different ways of analyzing things, and it's hard to second-guess a guy that's got 11 bracelets, but, you know. I really thought they did a very good job of it, and I think it is interesting enough to the viewers that it's going to be here to stay, and you're going to see more and more of this 50-minute delayed broadcasting.
Yeah, I thought they did a good job, too. As I've mentioned when they did the live streams earlier in the summer, as a broadcaster, I fully appreciate what Lon McCarron had to do as the play-by-play guy and keeping all the stuff he had to take care of business-wise in front of him and you know, asking questions of Antonio or Vanessa Russo, who showed up in the booth at one point, and Dave Tuchman did the same. They did a terrific job there. I do have to mention two quick things. I like having Antonio and Hellmuth in the booth together because these guys obviously have a rivalry. I don't know if they don't like each other personally, but I know that Antonio doesn't respect Phil's game and vice versa. So there was one hand where I can't remember who the players were, but Hellmuth said, I think that this guy has ace-10, which would have completed a straight at that point on the river, and it seemed like an ace-10 was unlikely, and Antonio even said, Phil, there's no way he has ace-10. Absolutely no way. There's no way he has ace-10 in this situation. And he had ace-10 in that situation, and Phil held that over Antonio for about the next 30 minutes.
That was actually Martin is the one who had the hand, and he caught it on the river, and it was one of the first couple of times where he actually made a stab post-flop at a pot.
Yep.
And he basically bet on the turn with pure air with a king high in his hand and caught the miracle card. No.
Yeah,
ace
high
in his hand. Yeah, ace high in his hand, sorry. Caught the miracle gut shot for the straight on the river so that he then has a monster. And then he turned around and overbetted on the river and didn't get a good value out of it. But still, you know, I did not put him on that hand. And if Phil put him on, more power to him, because I guarantee I did not. I was agreeing with Antonio on that one.
Now, there was another hand, and I just want to mention this because the commentary was so interesting, but also there's something that relates back to our show from last week, and this was a hand between Owen O'D and P.S. Hines, where I think O'D had 4-bet preflop, and Hines had flatted, and then Hines tanked on the turn when O.D. bet $8.2 million. You know, the details of the flop aren't that important, but Hines tanked on the turn when O.D. bet $8.2 million on the turn, and he tanked and tanked and tanked, and it was 5 minutes he tanked. And at that point, Antonio was in there with Lon, and Vanessa was in the booth as well, and they were discussing what they thought he had. And at one point, Hines made a face that they called the folding face. He's been thinking this long. When you make that face, you're definitely folding. He's made the decision. He's definitely folding. Another 30 or 40 seconds went by, and Hines announced he was all in. And they were shocked. Antonio and Vanessa were absolutely shocked. And when I saw that, I thought to myself, he's got a monster. And it goes back to what we discussed last week when we were doing analysis of a listener's hand, a guy named Steve who'd written in. He'd been in a hand where he flopped top full house and then had fake tanked with the nuts on the turn and then had shoved, and the other guy had folded. And in this hand, OD did fold to Hines, but it was the same thing. Somebody thinking and thinking and thinking and thinking and thinking and then shoving. When someone does that against you in a game, you have to do the same thing that Steve's opponent did and OD did in this hand against Hines, which is recognize that this was all a show, that he really does have something big. Now, it paid off here because OD didn't have anything. He had ace-queen, two red cards, and there were three clubs on the board, and it turned out that Hines had a pair of queens with the queen of clubs, so he had a redraw even if he was wrong if another club were to come on the river. But at that point, it was a classic example of the tank, shove monster hand that we had just talked about last week, and it fooled Antonio and Vanessa right up until that point.
I'm going to remember that the next time I play Antonio, because to me, when somebody takes that long and then shoves, I better have the nuts or I'm running.
Yep.
They're just 99% of the time they've got it. You just don't take that long and then not fold. If you're taking that long and then you shove, you've been trying to figure out some way to get more chips out of him. You couldn't come up with anything. You finally decided, well, then I'm just going to push in. Maybe he'll think it's weak, or maybe he's got, you know, a drawing hand of some sort that he can call me with because he's got so many chips in the middle. But, I will have to admit, he took that long and then shoved, and a gasp went up in the whole audience out there. Nobody thought he was going to shove for taking that long.
Yep.
So it worked that far. But I'm telling you, I'd have had my cards in the muck so fast. And he did muck them. So.
While we're analyzing play here, one of the things that I found a little weird about Ben Lamb's play was a couple of times when they were down to five, and then even when they got down to four, I guess this was when the blinds were still 500,000 and a million. He would open for just, you know, 2.1, 2.2, something like that, and then he would fold to a three bet. And at the time, he didn't have a huge stack. He had 25, 27, maybe 30 million. And he did this several times where he was not one of the chip leaders. You know, if you were P.S. Hines and you had 75, 80, 90, 100 million in chips, to put a couple million out there as a three, as a raise preflop is one thing. But when you only have maybe effectively an M of 15 there, can you be doing that, Dennis? You know tournament strategy better than I do, and were you surprised to see Ben doing that?
Well, to back up a minute, when Hines was doing it, I was actually sitting with Bernard Lee over in the press box, and it got to be almost comical because earlier when there were six and seven people there, 1.8 was a bid from him on two-thirds of the hands, I think. It just automatically would come around. We started to wonder if he was even looking at his cards. It was just an automatic 1.8, 1.8, 1.8. But again, he had a dominant chip stack, and if he had anything at all, even any kind of drawing cards, he's going to put pressure on everybody else, and a lot of them were folding to him. They didn't want to get in a hand with him because they knew he's quite capable of three-betting him back. But when Ben was doing it, he was one of the shorter stacks. And when somebody comes over the top and bets what's, in effect, a quarter of his chips for him to call, he's now in a very awkward position. If he just calls, he's going to be chipped down a lot if he misses the flop. And if he shoves, he could be shoving, and, you know, it's his tournament life. And he was raising so many hands, he had to be doing it a lot of times very light. His idea behind it was that there was 500,000 and a million in there for the blinds, plus, well, I think another 100, 150,000 for the Andes. There was basically 2 million in the pot. So he raises it 2.1. If he can take down half of those, then, you know, he's breaking even. And plus, it's very difficult for people to put him on hands when he does catch a monster. The problem was, at this table, nobody was letting him get away with it. Hines had enough chips, he would three-bet him any time he wanted to. If Matt had any kind of a hand, he could three-bet him at any time. It just wasn't the proper time to be doing that move. So I kind of agree with you that it was a very risky move, and it didn't pay off for him. It's basic strategy when you're short around the table. If the table will let you do it, you can chip up. If the table's not going to let you do it, you better back down or you're going to be in trouble.
When they start playing again tonight around 8 o'clock Central Time on ESPN, we've got a 22-year-old from Germany, Pius Hines. You got a 26-year-old from Las Vegas in Ben Lamb and a 35-year-old Czech in Martin Staszko. Which of the three is best for poker if he wins?
Wow. No offense to Martin, but he's very stoic, very quiet, very unassuming. I can easily see how he's a great chess player. I don't think he will go out and promote poker. Your 22-year-old is quite flamboyant, still in the party mode, still very young, still needs some maturing, plays some great poker, don't get me wrong. But, again, I'm not for sure how positive he's going to be for poker. He may be in a few years. I think you're going to have to, of the three of them, probably Ben Lamb would be best for poker at the immediate time and best in helping it out. He's a good interview. He's going to continue to play. He's played professionally for a number of years now, had quite a bit of success. If I have to pick one of the three, it would probably be Ben Lamb that would be best for poker.
Does the fact that we don't have legalized, regulated, licensed online poker in the United States now affect that? Maybe a German is better for poker in Europe now. This was the most international final table we've ever had, after all.
And you may be right. Perhaps by making it more popular in all the other countries around there. Maybe if a German wins it and it blossoms in Germany and over in Europe and even, you know, grows even in a bigger scope than it is right now, that'll put pressure back on the U.S. That'll put pressure on the DOJ when they see the success and they see the revenue and everything and see how much people are enjoying it. I don't know. It would be a good thing for German poker, I'm quite sure. But, that's a no-brainer. You know, they had a guy over there that used to swing a tennis club that won it when he was very young, and he did a lot for tennis over there in Germany. So I'm quite sure that the poker world could use somebody in Germany.
Yeah. It was weird watching this for the first year with no Poker Stars patches, no Full Tilt Poker patches, no Everest Poker on the felt, no Internet Poker having any presence whatsoever. I didn't see any logos except for Ben Lamb wearing Aria gear, the Aria, the casino resort in Las Vegas that has signed up some of these pros. Does anybody else have any kind of deal? I mean, Martin Staszko was wearing like a laminated Czech flag pin on his shirt. Do the other guys, have they made any money from this, do you know?
Some, yes. Nowhere near the volume that it has in the last few years. But P.S. Hines actually signed a deal last week with PokerStars, and if he takes this down, they'll have him all around Europe and everything and being promoted, and he will probably get a very nice deal from them. There was another gentleman up there, I'm trying to remember which one, wearing a Bellagio shirt. There were a couple of small tags for training sites and that were on some different shirts. Very, very little, though. And the massive amount of sponsorship that was in there in 07, 08, 09 is gone.
Yeah.
And I'm not for sure it'll ever come back.
It would be pretty amazing if PokerStars has another world champion.
Wouldn't that be unbelievable?
Yeah. Of course, for them, that, you know, it can't be Ben Lamb because of the
right.
DOJ. And by the way, we know that there's news about the DOJ. Nothing breaking today or yesterday, and nobody's gotten any money back or is going to get it back this week. We'll have more coverage on that on next week's show, when we'll also have Barry Greenstein on. He and Linda Johnson are being inducted into the Hall of Fame in just a couple of hours before the final three play it out. We do want to get a couple of things in here before we get to the end of the show, which is include plugs for upcoming events, one of which is with our friends at the Hollywood Casino in Lawrenceburg, Indiana.
Absolutely. They've got their Fall Classic coming up. It starts here in just a few days. Their main event then is on the 19th and 20th of November over there at Lawrenceburg. Again, you can fly into Cincinnati, and it's a short drive over to the casino. On Thursday, they've got the Deep Stack people coming in with the Grinder and I think Mike the Mouth, and they're going to be conducting a school. Chad Brown, a friend of mine, Vanessa's husband, is going to be flying in there. He'll be playing in their main event. I'll be over there playing in their main event. They had a real good turnout last year. Hopefully, they'll have just as good this year. And as always, Kevin and the boys over there will take care of you. They treat you really, really well.
All right. I also want to plug a charity event coming up here in the St. Louis area at the American Legion Hall in O'Fallon on Saturday, November 19th. This is an event for the Galactosemia Organization, which helps out kids with rare genetic metabolic disorders. It's a $60 buy-in and $30 rebuys and add-ons. It'll go on at the American Legion Hall on North Penn Street in O'Fallon, Illinois, on Saturday the 19th. If you want information, you can call Michelle at 618-979-2846. We're happy to help plug that for them. And here at Harrah's St. Louis, we've got the 5-10 game. We've got the PLO game. I'm going to go jump back into one of those. And Dennis and I will regroup, and he'll have stories to tell next week about what happens tonight at the Rio. And then I'm guessing later in the week, you'll probably play a little deep stack action over at the Venetian, because that's going on as well, isn't it?
Absolutely will. I think I'm up and running and ready to get back to the tables. My little recuperating time was nice, but it's over. It's time to get back to work.
I'm glad to hear you're healthy again, and I'll talk to you next week.
All right. Take care.
He's Dennis Phillips in Las Vegas. I'm Paul Harris at Harrah's St. Louis. This is the Final Table Poker Radio Show, live every Tuesday at 3 on 5 Night of the Fan, KFNS, and KFNS.com. And our podcast available on demand anytime from iTunes and thechipleader.com.